Hello, welcome to the Eating for Health podcast. I'm Dr. Harriet Holm, founder of Healthy Eating Doctor, registered nutritionist and doctor. I studied medicine at Cambridge University, worked in the NHS for over a decade, have a PhD in genetics, lecture on nutrition, and was commissioned to write a novel degree combining culinary skills, nutrition and health. I'm on a mission to break down nutrition myths and share science-backed nutrition to help empower you. I'll share some interviews, theories and practical tips focused around nutrition and health. Stay tuned to find out more. It was a real pleasure to talk with Dr. Anjali Arman, who's a consultant in diabetes and endocrinology at a London teaching hospital. She has a PhD looking at the effects of protein on appetite and gut hormones, and is a mother of three children and a keen advocate of healthy eating for the whole family. Follow her on Instagram at The Kitchen Doctor and Mum. So I'm really delighted to have Anjali Arman with me today, and she is an endocrinologist, so a hormone doctor, and she's going to tell you a little bit about herself.
Hi there, Harriet. Thank you so much for having me. So I'm a diabetes and endocrine specialist, so mainly deal with type 2 diabetes and hormone problems in the general population. And I work at a London teaching hospital, where I do both diabetes endocrinology clinics, but I'm also a general physician as well.
So are you on the general medical on-call rota then?
Oh yes.
So, oh gosh, I've been very busy then over the last year with COVID.
Yes, it has been extraordinary. I've been on all sorts of emergency rotas, and I've been doing sort of general on-calls. It's been quite full on the last year.
Gosh, I'm sorry, you must be needing a well-earned break, I imagine. How did your endocrinology patients, how did your diabetes patients fare in that? Were you still running clinics, or were you struggling with that?
Yeah, it was interesting actually, because obviously there was a real push that COVID needed to take precedence over every other medical condition. And, you know, of course, that was absolutely the right thing in last March. What we did with a lot of other medical specialties and general practice is convert mostly to virtual clinics, so telephone and video clinics, which, you know, we probably didn't cancel that many patients even initially. We just telephoned everyone. People were very understanding. And actually what we realised through COVID is that actually you can do things in other ways, and actually it can be really quite successful. So fortunately, all of my clinics carried on, which is great.
Well, that's really amazing. And I guess then some good things have come out of a really horrendous year for most people.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and I won't pick your brains too much more about COVID, because I think we've all probably had quite a fill of it over the last year, and I'm sure you're probably sick to death of talking about it anymore. And the really reason I asked you to come on here is really to talk about diet and diabetes and hormones. So first of all, sort of what got you into endocrinology in the first place? What was your sort of main interest?
So it's funny, actually. So I loved all the medical specialties when I was a junior doctor. So, you know, surgical specialties just weren't for me. And what I loved about endocrinology is all the numbers, all the sort of hormones that went up and down, and being able to work out what was wrong with someone based on blood tests. And also just learning about sort of human physiology, how the body just naturally adapts itself to the hormones and sort of regulates itself, just fascinated me. The idea of this concept of negative and positive feedback, which, you know, I can talk about if you want me to, but is, you know, it's sort of the body's own way of keeping your hormones in check, just was something that I was really interested in. And of course, diabetes, I'm so fascinated by the human diet and the effect that the diet that we have can have an impact on your health, that type 2 diabetes for me is something that I'm really passionate about improving people's perception of what diabetes is and what they can do for themselves, and empowering people to to take some control over their health. So those are my main reasons for choosing the specialty.
I mean, do you get much of an opportunity to speak about diet and prevention and lifestyle changes in clinic, or do you just not have the chance to do that?
No, well, actually, it's funny because traditionally, and in fact, we work very much as a multidisciplinary team, and I work very closely with really specialist dietitians, but I will still use every opportunity in my consultations to ask about diet to see if there's, you know, and I'm not saying that I'm the specialist, which of course I'm not when it comes to diet. It's just a small part of my job to signpost people, but also just to check, you know, whether they have any sort of immediate issues that they're having with their diet. And, you know, it's amazing that when you actually ask the right questions, that people really can think about their diet in a way that is, you know, people often think of diabetes diets as very restrictive diets. And actually what the way I talk to my patients about it is that it's not meant to be restrictive. Because, of course, we don't want people to be really miserable and cut out every enjoyable food in their life. It's about having patterns that are sustainable long term for their own health, but also having, you know, the opportunity to indulge if they want to. If it's their birthday, I'm never going to stop somebody eating their cake. So it's those sorts of things that I do try and pick up on in my clinics.
No, that sounds very similar to the dietary advice I give, that people should really be thinking about how to widen their diet, how to incorporate more healthy foods in and not feel restricted. And you're much more likely to keep up, you know, it's much more likely to be sustainable if you're able to do that. And instead of cutting out food groups, you're going to feel very restricted and it's going to be very difficult to maintain long term. So what sort of things then do your patients struggle with the most, do you find?
So I think the main thing that my patients suffer with is, well, it's difficult because obviously type 2 diabetes, there's a strong association with weight and weight gain, and people tend to overeat on, you know, very calorific foods. People often, you know, end up comfort eating through the fact that they feel like they can't lose weight and they have sort of negative perceptions about their body image, and it's just a sort of vicious cycle. So it's trying to disentangle some of that and actually stop people from thinking it's their own fault, but also, you know, that we can help, but also we can empower themselves to help themselves and make small, as you say, sustainable changes to both their diet, but also their lifestyle that they can manage, because there's no point giving them a plan that they're going to do for a week and then they're going to go back to their normal pattern. It's all about sort of small steps, but also offering the support. It's like clinical studies. You know, this, when you have a clinical study, patients are more motivated to do something because there's somebody checking in on them. And similarly, you know, my dietitians work really closely with my patients and, you know, they regularly have appointments or emails and those sorts of things, I think, really motivate people to keep going.
No, I agree. Absolutely. And that accountability, that you know that someone's going to be checking in and that, you know, they're going to be asking about what you've been eating, what your diet's like. I think it's really motivating. I certainly find that. No, that's great. So I love your Instagram account. I love all the different healthy recipes that you share, particularly your Asian inspired ones, because I love Asian food. And I think I've got incredible respect for you as not only a consultant in the NHS, who's obviously been through a very difficult year, but just in general, you know, being a consultant in the NHS is a tough job. But as a mum of three as well, how on earth do you find the time to run your Instagram account as well?
Oh, you're so kind. Thank you. Well, I suppose it's funny because people always think about Instagram as content creations, and I've never really thought of it in that way. For me, it's about just showing people what I actually eat. You know, my husband will vouch for the fact that this is actually the food that we eat for supper. And yes, I've got three kids. It is a juggle, I'll be honest with you. But, you know, I work part time. So that I can have some time at home with my family. You know, I've got three kids that are still quite young. And so I do try and be organized if I can. I try and sort of plan meals if I can, and it doesn't always work, but I do have some sort of idea at the beginning of the week what I'm going to cook, and trying to stick to that. My husband is great. He also does a bit of cooking, and you know, we just kind of muddle along, and we do have help from parents, or at least we did before COVID. And I suppose those are the sorts of things that I just manage, and I'm sure everybody's got their own struggles that they deal with. And Instagram's just a little sort of outlet for me, and a way of just showing people that, you know, cooking doesn't need to be complicated. It doesn't need to have hundreds of ingredients, and actually you can do a relatively healthy meal quite quickly.
And you can do it while you're cooking for your kids, and healthy meals don't have to be boring. They can be tasty and interesting as well.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, that's, you know, I've got a family of food critics now, so I've got to make it somewhat interesting. But definitely, I agree. I think we've moved away from the idea of healthy eating just being green lettuce, and it's just so, you know, there's so much available, so much sort of plant-based food, there's so much that's also ready-made, ready-prepared stuff that's good, you know, easy to cook. So I also, you know, it's something I talk to my patients about, that, you know, often those that reach for the ready meals were actually, you know, cooking doesn't need to be that sort of stressful, unachievable thing that only certain people can do. It's all about being accessible for everybody.
No, I agree entirely. I think it's about having that little bit of preparation or thinking ahead as well sometimes, but not being so restricted that you can't deviate from that. But no, I think it's great. I also think it's quite hard to take photos of food that looks vaguely appetizing. So I think you're doing a great job.
Thank you.
And also, talking about your Instagram account and your recipes, have I got this wrong, or was your husband, did he actually create the whole book for you of all of your recipes? Is that right?
He's actually done two, would you believe? He's going to love hearing this. He knows how much sort of this all means to me, and I think I've been saying for many years, and you know, quite a few of my followers have asked as well if I'd ever write a book, and I'd love to write like a recipe book. It's something I, you know, I've always dreamed that I'd do, and I just haven't got round to doing, and a bit of an excuse, there's always something on, isn't there? And so I think he thought by just creating a couple of these books for me, it would sort of spur me on to actually get round to writing it myself. So yeah, it was very sweet. And they're both for birthdays, which is really lovely. It was a really lovely gesture.
No, they are really lovely. He's obviously very proud of you. It's really lovely. So you obviously cook a lot of different sort of types of food. Where does your inspiration come from? I mean, do you reach the cookery books? Where do you, you know, what inspires you?
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? My mum is a huge influence on my cooking, and she's always exposed us to, you know, foods from all over the world from a very young age. And so I think that's part of the reason I love cooking. I also, obviously, pre-COVID, loved travelling and loved, you know, all sorts of different cuisines. I think we've talked about Japan before, which has really, you know, that the trip to Japan inspired, you know, a lot of dishes that I make. And I love the sort of simplicity of the cooking, just a few really good quality ingredients on a plate, to me, is my idea of perfection. So I think travel, family, and also embracing my own culture. You know, I'm Indian, and being able to cook Indian food for my family so that my children appreciate their own roots is something that's been really important to me.
No, I think it's great. I think also it just makes food so much more interesting if you can mix it up and have all of those different flavors and different cuisines, because it's much less boring, isn't it? And you're exposed to all of those different tastes and, you know, phytochemicals and all the sort of good bits of different veggies. It's all sort of eat the rainbow, and all the same with then spices and miso, you know, all of the different ingredients. I think it's great, really. I'm going to talk now about something that really is one of my bugbears. And I think we connected at one point on Instagram because you wrote a post about this. And as an endocrinologist, a hormone doctor, I really wanted to get you on to sort of ask you what you thought on it, about it. So I frequently hear the phrase about balancing hormones. And to me, this just feels so such a sort of marketing gimmicky phrase. To me, the body has got such its own way of balancing its hormones. It's got its homeostatic mechanisms, its positive loops, its negative control mechanisms, that food really is not going to balance your hormones. It might help your long-term health and in diabetes, I guess, for example, in type 2 diabetes, eating the right diet in that regard can mean that you're not getting those same insulin spikes or sugar spikes. But really, that in general, food does not balance hormones. And if anyone is talking about that, then I think it's just not true. So I'd love to hear what you think about it.
Actually, I'm in total agreement with you. It's something that frustrates me incredibly because, as you say, the body has all sorts of homeostatic mechanisms that exist to naturally balance your hormones. You don't need to do anything yourself. What I do really feel for is that, the people that do buy into this are people that clearly have something that they want to attribute their symptoms or whatever it is to. So it's a way of sort of making their symptoms either real to them by saying, well, this is what I'll do, and by doing the smoothie or whatever it is, I'll be able to sort of naturally balance things, and it will work. And of course, that's the joy of placebo. So it's something that what worries me about, particularly on social media, is that it's real. It can be a real money-making thing as well. That, it's, as you say, marketing ploy, but also the products that you can find that are expensive products that really don't do anything other than maybe provide you with some vitamins or something. Often see things like teas and smoothies being marketed as natural ways to balance your hormones. And, unfortunately, it does play on, it preys on sort of young women that sort of impressionable, perhaps women that having, natural cycles, menstrual cycles, that, do feel sort of their symptoms over the course of their cycle may vary. People might feel a bit tired towards at the end of the cycle, for example, and think, actually, if I had this smoothie, it would naturally balance things and I'd feel much better. So I totally agree with you. And as you say, rightly so, there are situations like type 2 diabetes where diet certainly does play an influence on your hormone profile. But outside of that, there isn't a huge amount that diet can do. I mean, I see it often in the context of thyroid problems, and I'm not sure if that's something you've come across much, but there is, a small amount of evidence that factors such as iodine or selenium might play a very small role in thyroid hormone metabolism. But really outside of that, it's very difficult to regulate your hormones through your diet. Your body is doing it all the time. And the way I often talk to my patients about it is it's like a thermostat. So, if the house is too cold, the thermostat kicks in and the heating switch is on and it heats up your home. And that's what it's like at the thyroid level. So if you're not producing enough thyroid hormone, something kicks in, you produce thyroid hormone and everything goes back to the lovely warm state it should be in. So I think it's an easy way for people to understand what the body sort of naturally does. So I'm totally with you. It's frustrating. I think the only way really to address it is education. And, unfortunately, as I said, there are always going to be people here that want to prey on those that genuinely have symptoms that perhaps aren't due to hormones, but they want it to be due to hormones because at least they have a diagnosis that way.
I agree. And so it's really great to hear you saying the same thing. I also think it's really sad to see these people that are vulnerable, that are preyed upon by people sort of talking about it. And that I think that in many ways, it's an easy, quick fix. It'd be lovely to think that all of your symptoms would go away, as you say, with a smoothie or anything. But I think there's sort of a darker side as well with the sort of the marketing of the, you know, I'll take this supplement and it's sort of a money-making thing. And also the raft of blood tests that go along with it. I see, you know, people who've had, you know, their serum rebob, you know, they've had everything done in the sort of the name of balancing hormones. And I think, gosh, that must have cost you a fortune to have had that done. And really it was completely unnecessary. And your hormones aren't going to be balanced. It doesn't really matter what they are because your body's taking care of them most of the time. And most of these, they're completely irrelevant to any of your dietary issues. So I think it's really sad, and I find it really frustrating. But a lot of the time, those are sort of the sexy headlines that, you know, blow up on social media or an influencer or in a newspaper, that, you know, balance your hormones with a smoothie of, you know, spinach or whatever the latest superfood or thing is. So I guess, as you say, it's just about sharing that educational message that your body is doing a good job of balancing themselves, and eat healthily for your long-term health and not for immediate balancing of your hormones. They'll take care of themselves. I just want to talk a bit about your PhD, because it sounds really fascinating to me. And I just wonder if you could tell us a little bit about it, why you chose the topic, and then I'll ask you a little bit about what functional foods are afterwards.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. So my PhD was looking at the effect of protein on appetite. And it was something I was really interested in because, you know, we've learned so much about the gut over the last sort of 10, 15 years. And actually, the gut is the largest endocrine gland in the body, and it produces a whole host of hormones that do all sorts of things. And, you know, we're learning a lot more about the gut microbiome that works very closely with gut hormones. And so my PhD was essentially looking to see, so we know that protein is the macronutrient that makes people feel the most full compared to carbohydrate and fat. But what we don't know is, what is it about protein that makes people feel full? And what I was trying to work out was whether there was something about the amino acids within the protein that was actually making people feel full. And so I looked at a variety of different amino acids in both cells, but also in humans, to see if we give people amino acids on their own, can you actually have an impact on the release of gut hormones in response to a meal? And so it's really interesting. It's still a lot of work in progress, but it's amazing to see that actually you can influence how full you feel through amino acids. The reason for doing that, which brings me quite nicely onto your other question about functional foods, is it would be really interesting to see. So the idea of these functional foods is that you take a normal food and you enhance its, you know, its nutritional benefits, if you like. And so what I was looking at was whether there was any possibility that we could take a normal, I don't know, let's say an energy bar, and you supplement it with amino acid X, which you found to be very good at stimulating your gut hormones, and you give it to people and people eat less. And obviously we know that body weight is incredibly complex, and the idea of food intake and energy expenditure being the main determinants of body weight. So if, in theory, you could reduce the food intake, there is a possibility with the current rising trend in obesity that you could influence that, and you could perhaps stop the very steep rise that we're currently seeing, sadly, and try and, you know, halt the progression by getting people to just eat less food through the idea of these functional foods. So it's a really interesting area, and I don't know if you've got any other insight into this, but that was part of my PhD, which I absolutely loved doing. I really did.
No, I think it's fascinating. I just wonder sort of how quickly we'll see these type of enhanced functional foods on the shelves.
Yeah, it's interesting because So in order to, so that we don't have a huge number of drugs that tackle obesity on the market, and in order to develop a drug, you are looking probably at 15 to 20 years from the start of a clinical study, whereas functional foods, because of the regulations with regard, they're under sort of food law rather than drug law, actually you could be looking at something within 5 or 10 years, which is amazing considering it might be 20 years before you see a drug. So the idea that you can develop these foods fairly quickly is definitely sort of work in progress. I'm sure we'll see more of it in the future. I mean, just take sort of protein powders and protein supplements as a sort of starting point and see where we are now.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I guess it'll be really interesting to see, you know, the sort of idea that the functional food will make you feel full quicker, and so you won't be sort of feeling hungry on a reduced diet, you'll be feeling full and satiated. So was there any difference then between animal-based protein and plant protein? Because often anecdotally it's normally sort of animal protein that you generally feel fuller, or I sort of feel fuller with, but was that borne out in the laboratory then? Did you find that as well? Or
no, not really. I mean, I suppose the difficulty with the animal protein, with the plant protein, it's very difficult to get a sort of 100% protein, whereas, you know, you give yourself a chicken breast and you're eating almost pure protein, where it's very difficult to remove the carbohydrate, etc., that goes with most plant protein. So I think that's where the sort of difficulty lies in comparing like for like. And we just looked at individual amino acids. We didn't look at animal versus plant, but from, you know, all of the sort of literature that I've read, it's very difficult to study them head to head in that way.
No, it's really interesting, and I think it's huge work, as you say, sort of more work to be done on it, and watch this space. It'll be really interesting to see what comes out of it. And obviously with obesity being such a huge problem, I think the same about the microbiota, that we're only in our infancy about understanding what that, the role that has to play in obesity as well. Sort of the mice studies of where you can have the same diet and transplant from an obese human, transplant their feces in, and the mouse gains weight, and you can reverse it then with the feces from a thin human. I think that's really incredible. It's so much more than just the energy balance. Obviously energy balance is really important, but it's a really fascinating topic. I think we've got a lot to learn, and we need to learn it quickly with the rising trends in obesity and all of the risk that then causes for long-term disease. So one other question I just had was about polycystic ovary syndrome. So do you see many women with PCOS?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I do, in my general endocrine clinic, we do see a lot of patients with PCOS. It's a really hard condition to treat, firstly, as an endocrinologist. You're dealing with young women, and the way that I sort of approach it is, you know, number one, are you wanting to try for a baby, yes or no? Because your management is very different if they are trying for a baby. Now, the vast majority aren't. So in that population, it's hard. It's very hard because you're dealing with mostly, although there is a small percentage of this lean PCOS that we see, but mostly you are dealing with overweight or obese women. And we know that weight loss does work in terms of improving cycles. The other thing that it can do is improve the insulin resistance, obviously, through the weight loss, and that can have an impact on their other symptoms such as facial hair or acne. But it is hard, you know, because what are women supposed to do? You tell them to exercise and eat well. It's one of the other areas, going back to our discussion on social media, where, you know, there isn't a PCOS diet as such that, you know, we prescribe, because if there was, we'd be prescribing it. And I see a lot of information on social media from sort of hormone PCOS consultants who aren't really medical doctors, but who give this advice on what the best diet for PCOS is, you know, even things like exclude gluten from your diet. I mean, there is no evidence that excluding gluten from somebody's diet is going to improve symptoms in PCOS or thyroid or whatever it is. So the mainstay with PCOS is try and regulate cycles, and that might be through the pill, for example, but at the same time, at every stage, you know, we will wholeheartedly advocate diet and lifestyle measures, however the woman can achieve it. And I'm never going to say to my patients, you must go and do a low carb diet because that is what is going to work. You know, we just don't have the evidence that that is the treatment for PCOS. So all we know is that losing weight does help. And how women do it is a different matter. And as we said earlier, it has to be something that's sustainable for them. It's otherwise just going to come back again.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's again another sort of area of unmet need, an area where there's no clear treatment, and so people are often really desperate, and they're looking for answers, and that sort of plays into that sort of vulnerability. I often find the sort of balancing hormones is part of PCOS as well. And I find people, you know, have sort of been around the houses a lot. They've often done lots of these courses, or they spent lots of money doing various diets. And I think it's quite sad, actually, a lot of the time. And I think, you know, it'd be lovely to have that quick fix, but it's just not there. It's about that sustainable, healthy diet. So do you use any supplements at all? Because I know sort of there are lots of ones that are quite trendy with PCOS, like myo-inositol. Have you come across that, and do you recommend it at all?
I don't recommend it in my clinical practice. Of course, you know, people, I'm never going to stop my patients from trying it. You know, there's, you know, most supplements, I say most, are usually without harm, but you know, sometimes not myo-inositol, but you know, there are other things that people do try that actually can be harmful. So I don't generally advise supplements, but I'd never stop them. And if they wanted to try alternative things in conjunction with, you know, traditional Western medicine, that's absolutely fine with me. You know, I do appreciate that the population that we're treating in PCOS is, you know, a young, generally young females, that, you know, the symptoms such as the facial hair or the acne can be really, really, you know, awful. Depressing. For them. Really, really awful. You know, the psychological things that can go along with that can be really problematic. And so, and you know, as I said, it's a really difficult condition to treat from a medical perspective, because patients just aren't that happy at the end because there is no immediate quick fix. That's the problem.
And also those symptoms, as you say, it's not just the acne and the hair, but the infertility side of it as well are such distressing, you know, fundamental, you know, problems. Yes. That I think it's no wonder that they're, you know, find it really challenging that there's no, you know, quick fix or cure, and it's really sad. I think
we definitely need more work into PCOS. I find it the least satisfactory part of my clinical practice, and there's definitely an unmet need in these women that I really feel for. You know, women, you know, funnily enough, it tends not to be the infertility side of things that women seek help for in the first instance, because they probably don't make that association. It tends to be the facial hair and the acne that really bothers them. And then, okay, their periods might be irregular, and actually they realise, yes, that might have an impact on them having a baby in the future. But it tends to be the visible physical issues that really bother them. And as I said, because there is no quick fix for these things, often these women might have laser treatment for facial hair growth. But it's, you know, at the time of when they're in the prime of their life and they're dealing with all of these really awful symptoms, I really feel for them. And I really wish that we do improve the way we manage PCOS generally, and in the hope that we understand more about the insulin resistance, which seems to be the driving force in PCOS.
No, I agree. It's an area that, you know, really warrants research, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. 100%.
Great. Well, it's been such a pleasure talking with you. And I feel I've, you know, learnt lots from you, and I'm really grateful to have you on. So thank you very much.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure. I really enjoyed it.
I really hope you enjoyed listening, and I'd love if you'd give me a 5-star review and subscribe so that other people can find me too. I'm also at Healthy Eating Doctor on Instagram, and I have lots more nutrition education information on both my video courses and on my website, healthyeatingdoctor.com.